Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our evening. Dharma talk in exchange. It's always a pleasure to be here. At the same time, it's always a challenge to think, okay, what is the appropriate thing to say at this moment when the possibilities are infinite of what to say or not say, let's say. And I was thinking of this morning, I exchanged some text messages with Gena Roshi, my teacher, who is away for the week in Burgundy, taking a break in the country. And so we were just exchanging some informational type things. And then she said, she ended in her message, We just finished sitting outside in the sun, surrounded by greenery and birdsong. And then the next sentence was, but in the evening, because it's so humid, we need to put the heat on. And this sounds like a completely just ordinary statement, you know. But what strikes me about it is there's absolutely no judgment. It's just when we sat, she doesn't say we were surrounded by amazing greenery and beautiful birdsong. It was just the fact we sat in the sun, in the greenery, surrounded by greenery and birdsong. And then in the evening, because it's so humid, we need to put on the heat. Just so simple. And that's like the simplicity of this practice and that's what we're seeking. We think we're seeking something really incredibly mystical and esoteric and wild and crazy and, you know, life-changing. Well, and it is life-changing because it's so simple, let's say. Gena Roshi, I don't even know if she realizes that that's what she wrote. Of course she realizes that what she wrote, but it's just so much a part of her experience of the day that it doesn't seem like anything extraordinary. It's like that, we have a koan of someone asked, I think it's Tozan's Hot and Cold, I think it's something like that. Where someone asks, a monk asks Tozan, how can we get to that place that's beyond hot and cold? And Tozan says, when it's hot, kill yourself with the heat. When it's cold, kill yourself with the cold. Which is just another way of what Gena Roshi said. When we sit outside in the sun, surrounded by greenery and birdsong, we said that's it. In the evening, when we go inside and it's damp, we put on the heat. That's it. The whole thing is just that. In our study group, we've been talking about the Four Noble Truths and the notion of what makes us suffer is wanting what we don't have, getting what we don't want. So, you know, when we're in the sun, we want it to be cool. And when we're in the cool, we want it to be hot, something like that. Having the idea that, well, it's June 3rd, we shouldn't have to put on heat at night, right? Or it's June 3rd, so of course there's sun and birdsong and greenery. without just acknowledging this is what it is. We very quickly move into other things, what we don't want, what we want. And then, as our text was telling us, that brings up a lot of suffering, because there's fear and anger and despair and attachment, loss, all kinds of things that are around this getting what we don't want and not getting what we want. And it takes, it takes all kinds of different forms, if we look at it. So I take a sip of my tea, which is not as hot as it was a half an hour ago when I sat down here. And so then I could be thinking, oh, I wish it was hot, Why can't I have a hotter tea? Or I don't like this tea, or any number of things, right, that arise in my head and in my position and whatever. But if I take a sip of the tea and it's just this. It's just this without expecting it to be something else. That requires letting go of what I want it to be, though. And this is very familiar. We hear talk about this all the time in our practice, letting go of how we want things to be. And it takes on tragic consequences, something totally understandable and yet tragic. With my family last night, we were talking about the whole thing with Donald Trump, who's been convicted 34 times guilty of the crimes that he's accused of. And, in my family, people were saying, yeah, but it's not making any difference in the election in the US. The people who support him, they don't care. And the people who don't support him do care, and they don't understand why the people who don't support him, who do support him, don't care. And my brother made this interesting point where he said, in polling with the Hispanic communities in the United States, that and the Hispanic communities are generally at the bottom of the scale. They're the poorest, the most precarious situations. They don't have steady jobs. Some of them are illegal. Their jobs they do have don't pay very well. They do jobs that no one else wants to do. Very, very, they don't have any health care. So they tend to be sick or ruined because they need health care. They need to pay for health care, whatever. So my brother said that he had read that in the Hispanic communities, people, they don't care about this illegal stuff of Trump's because they don't want immigration, because they fear new immigrants will take whatever little scraps they have already. And they fear that they will be even cheaper labor and they will lose then whatever status they have. And this is kind of the classic thing with immigrant communities. They, at least in America, that's the story of the immigration. So, the initial English people didn't like the French who immigrated. They didn't like the Irish who immigrated. Then they didn't, nobody liked the Italians who immigrated. And then nobody liked the Polish people who immigrated, and nobody liked the Germans. It's just like it's ongoing thing where the other who arrives later, we don't want. So in these Hispanic communities, they don't care. And they're kind of even like, it means nothing to me, to them. Cheating on your accounting in a business, I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with their life. And they really don't care. They want to protect their status, which is pretty low. And they feel that the other candidates, Biden's policies, who is not anti-immigration, who is not providing what they think are economic guarantees that Trump would provide. So they feel threatened, and so they don't want to vote for Biden. So then you think this, and you think this is tragic, because this is focusing on this one aspect and not realizing that the bigger picture is that the country that they so much want to be a part of will no longer be that country if Trump is elected. No, things will change in that country that they so desperately want to be a part of. And th this is kind of an example of how we are blinded by self-interest. And it's totally understandable that people want to have enough to eat, they want to have a job, they want to be able to have a place to sleep. Absolutely understandable. They want to provide for their families. But our whole culture is based around this self-interest. This comes back to our text in the study group. That's the basic ground of our suffering comes from this ignorance, this basic ignorance of seeing not the true self. So being attached to possessions, being attached to an idea of self, an identity. So, of course, the Hispanic community, and even that's a gross generalization, because within the Hispanic community, there's the Mexicans, there's the Ecuadorians, there's the Panamanians, there's the Guatemalans, there's, all these different, and they then have their relationships with each other. And we become so attached to those identities that we lose sight of just sitting in the sun. With greenery and birdsong and turning on the heat when it's cool in the evening. Of course, many of these people don't even have the possibility to turn on the heat. So we can understand this position that they have. And I'm not saying they should do anything differently. It just speaks to me. It is an illustration of what happens, and we see this on the global scale of when we're attached to identities and positions. So this very simplistic, not simplistic, but very simple, when it's hot, kill yourself with heat. When it's cold, kill yourself with cold. Which is just a way of saying, don't discriminate. Don't attach to something other than what is. So if I drink the tea, then it's not hot like it was a half an hour ago. But it's fine. There's no problem with that. And then we see how this then happens throughout the day, every moment, wanting things to be different, having expectations. So you come here and you expect a Dharma talk, and you don't know what will be said. We're usually comfortable with that. We don't know what will be said in the Dharma talk. We're pretty comfortable with that. But however, very quickly we start, when someone starts talking, giving the Dharma talk, we start thinking, oh, well, what about this? Or, I don't really agree with that. Or, oh, but she could also say that. Instead of just staying with it, just receiving it. Which is really hard to do. We see that in the talking circle when we do it, of just receiving what is said. So that's the equivalent of when it's hot, just be hot, be totally hot. That's what that kill yourself with the heat means, is just be totally hot. No tiny scrap of yourself that is not hot. And when in the talking circle, we encounter that, right? people talk, and sometimes our mind floats, or we're looking at someone else in the circle who's doing something, who's yawning or changing position, or we're wondering about the time because we're the cook or we're the server or the per whatever the person is saying. We're bored with it or whatever. Or we feel great compassion for that person because they're crying. And then we get lost in that. Now, we might be completely compassionate and crying and not be lost. See, it's a very fine line of being totally what is or getting lost in it. So I don't know in Geno Roshi's situation what if she gets caught up in what bird is that singing, or I wonder what those plants are, or I hope the sun stays like this for the whole week I'm here, or something. I don't know. Possibly. She probably has moments like that too. But that's not what she wrote to me. And this was in a text message, so it was not something like really well thought out. It was like we were exchanging notes. But that's also the fruit of decades of sitting, decades of doing this practice. She's on vacation, right? And she sits meditation in the morning. And some people tell me, oh, yeah, I don't have any time. Or then next week I'll be on vacation, so I don't have time. And we find all sorts of reasons not to sit. And in my experience of my teacher is, I can't think of very many days since I've known her where she doesn't sit. Great example, really good example. She also lives in a Zen center, so she has this advantage of having other people sitting there too. Although now she's on holiday, and you think she could just not sit? No. No, that's part of the holiday for her is sitting in the sun with the greenery and the bird song. And so, when I heard that what my brother said, that also brings me to my own blindness. So what is it that I'm not seeing? What is my position? Trying to take a step back and not become caught in calculation and attachment. So if we come back to that story with Trump, where people some people on his side, on Trump's side, so it's about sides, right, say, well, everybody does this, all businessmen do this, so why is he being prosecuted? It's politicized because everybody does it and others don't get penalized for it. Or then, some people are calculating, oh, well, it's probably would have been better if he wasn't convicted because now he's going to become a martyr and that won't be good for the election. And there's all these calculations of what should have been done instead of convicting him, which is just really just staying attached to different positions instead of just looking at the situation and saying, well, this is the law. Doesn't matter if everybody else does it and they don't get arrested for it, which is not actually true. A lot of people in New York City, a lot of businessmen are convicted of these same crimes, but instead of saying, oh, well, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't do that because then it's going to be worse for the Democrats. But that's missing the point of just what is. So if we say this is the law, well, then that's what the law is. And if we start then determining whether, with calculations, whether it's good or bad to prosecute someone for other purposes, then we're drifting from just sitting in the sun with greenery and birdsong. And we can do this every moment, right? When we sit, this is not, as we say, this is not rocket science. We can just sit down and appreciate, or just notice, maybe just notice, maybe not even appreciate. Appreciate's maybe too much. It's just notice. Okay, so this is where I am. I'm sitting, and maybe breathe in, breathe out, or something. Feel your feet on the ground. Feel your neck. Feel the top of your head. Just something to bring you back to here, so that if there's bird song, or if there's not, you notice it. If there's sun, if there's not, you notice it. If there's greenery, if there's not, you notice it. Where whatever it is, just it's just really about paying attention, being attentive to just this right here now. I came across this for some other completely reason. There's some Zen center in the United States that's called the Udambara Zen Center. And I thought, what does this mean, Udambara? And so I looked it up, and it's this, apparently, it's like even in the Lotus Sutra and in Pali and Sanskrit texts, the Udambara flower is considered extremely rare. And it only, according to some legends, it only blooms every 3,000 years. It's this, it has this mystical thing about it. Whatever, and I thought, this is weird. This doesn't sound Buddhist, really, but I had never heard of it before, but I haven't read those texts, so, and maybe it hits a different word in those texts, I don't know. And so in one of the things I found, it was Dogen talking about it. And so I wrote down a sentence about it where he says, a plum blossom in the snow is the one-time emergence of the Udambara flower. So I started thinking about that, and I thought, oh, so the Udambara flower, it's just what we would call mu or Buddha nature. It's just what is. Like we chant sometimes before the Dharma talk, this Dharma rarely encountered, even in millions of ages, And yet we encounter it every moment. We just don't see it. And so this plum blossom in the snow is the one-time emergence of the Udambara flower. But so is the greenery in Burgundy, where Ganeroshi is. So is the bird song. So is a yawn. So is a cough. So is my cat sleeping next to me. So is my warm tea. Every moment is the one-time emergence of the Udambara flower. Now, I don't know why the Zen center is called the Udambara Zen, let's say, Udambara Indian Farm Zen Center or something, but I guess they took that concept and made it into a thing. I don't know. I guess it's not different than ours, wildflower, right? The same thing. just a different word. And Dogen adds, how often do we see our Buddha Tathagata's true Dharma eye, yet miss his wink and fail to smile? So how often do we see it, and yet we miss it? We miss it. I guess he must have a whole text on this, on the Udambara flower. I don't know. I'll have to look that up. But probably we miss it more than we don't miss it, because we're looking somewhere else. We're looking for something else. We're not paying attention. Something like that. And yet the absolute beauty of the one-time emergence of the Udambara flower is just this right here, right now. It's this screen with all these squares on it. And it's each square, each person in each square is a one-time emergence of it. So maybe I will stop there and let someone else speak if they would like to. Add, comment, question.
Maybe I'll speak. Well, it's a practical question because I have lots of things to talk about, but I'm going to talk about something practical. You know, I met some friend, and she's a philosopher, and she's kind of interested in Buddhism, and I was wondering if I could invite her to these sessions. I don't think she knows anything about Buddhism. Can I invite her to these sessions, to participate in the sessions and the WhatsApp and, you know, retreats and everything?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. I'm not so sure about the WhatsApp. You know, that's more like for people who are already involved. But bring her to the sessions, bring her to retreat, and then if she likes it and wants to get involved, more involved, maybe then she could join the WhatsApp group. I don't know. Yeah, everybody's welcome. And if she needs some kind of instruction, then either you should give her some basics or ask someone else to give her some instructions.
Yes, because she doesn't know how to meditate, so the first 30 minutes would be probably a bit confusing for her, but...
Well, you could tell her what you do. You know.
Yeah. Okay.
And if she wanted more information, then she could get it at some other point, but yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do that. Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Hello, everyone. What you were saying made me think of, it's been raining a lot in Paris these past weeks, and biking in the rain is, you get wet. Then I was at a party Saturday. Went to a friend's place for birthday party, and on the stairs I met one of the friends, and she was carrying her helmet, bicycle helmet, and I asked her, so how are you coping with all that rain right now? It's really biking with all that rain is really annoying or whatever. I'm getting tired of it or something. It's like the sun to come back. Well, I didn't say all that, but that's what it meant. And she said, oh no, I'm just biking under the rain. And I said, yes, that's it. That's what it is. And I was thinking, well, I was just trying to do small talk. And she brought me right back to, it's just rain, that's what it is. And so I don't know if you can sit under the rain. I'm sure you can, but maybe not as comfortable as sitting under the sun. But yeah, that's just wanted to share that. Oh, and also something very funny on the screen, the way you are next to Joa, both are next to each other, and your back wall, Joa, is actually the same color in it, but I don't think it is. But on my screen, it's like a continuation of your room into Roshi's room. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, just talking. You mentioned Trump, and I saw a video today of or yesterday, with pro-Trump saying, reacting to him being convicted, and the woman was saying, "Oh, now he has street credibility. It's even better. He has street credibility, street cred." And I thought, what does it mean in terms of our practice? And I'm not sure, but it seems like it shows that it is so hard to drop our opinions and anything that
Yeah.
even things that seems to go against the stream, it actually could, from a cognitive point of view, we kind of rearrange things so that it actually helps us not to drop it, it seems. So I would ask the question, what would make change your mind? What would be the thing that would make change your mind? Is there anything that could make your change your mind? Yeah.
You would ask that to the Trump supporter, you mean? Yeah.
If that doesn't work for you, what would make it really just not change your mind? It's very hard. It's very hard to drop our opinions are when it's so rooted. And and I'm sure there are all kinds of psychological studies to explain that, but it's just brought me back to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and as Bernie Glassman, used to say, it's there's nothing but opinion, it's like just my opinion, man, he used to say. It's like it's all opinion. Of course, this is, not exactly what it sounds like, but it's so, as you say, it's so deep and so vast, our positions and how we see things and our attachments to them.
Well, maybe I'm gonna say maybe confirm Joa's viewpoint. So it's a bit depressing, but I don't know if you want me to say it or not. But this friend, she talks with a person from India, and she says, "Castes, the caste system is really good." It protects perfections, and I was also thinking how in India too, the government, which is a nationalist government, has prohibited the instruction of the theory of evolution, Darwin's evolution, and so that has vast consequences for that country, right? And it's all because of beliefs and prejudice.
No, oh, absolutely. Well, and that's where the Buddha was so radical, and that, of course, India was not what it is today, but the caste system was very strong, even in the Buddha's day, particularly in the Buddha's day. And he completely, it was radical. You know, everybody came, and there were no castes. You know, everybody was welcome, and didn't matter what clothes you had, where you came from, what caste, nothing. And he was really hated for that by a lot of, he'd driven away. That's part of the reason why they were nomadic, his sangha, because they would get places and people didn't want them there. It's really, really entrenched. I don't know, Joy, have you ever, I remember something that the Buddha said about castes when I think it was the king, who's his name? What's that king? Padamba or Pananda or whatever.
Pasadena.
Whatever that king is that he talks with a lot.
Pasadena.
And he, so he, the guy, the king asks him about castes. And he said, so, you know, if you ask, if someone is to build a fire out of pine wood, and they go and find wood and it's from a pine tree, fine, okay. And then another one goes and gets wood from a mango tree, and another one goes and gets wood from another kind of tree. I forget, there's four different kinds of trees. And he said, would the nature of what is produced be any different? He asks the king this, so the warmth, the light, the quality of the fire is the same, no matter what the wood is. The wood looks different, the plant is different, it produces different branches and tree and fruit and leaves and whatever, but the nature of the fire is the same. So even, there are instances of this even in his text where he specifically addresses the caste system. And it's very, very tenacious because it still exists today. And people think it's good, And maybe we have this opinion that it's bad, maybe we're completely wrong. I don't know. I don't know. Once, when we had a peacemaker retreat at Dana with Bernie Glassman, some people were staying in the house. A couple from London were staying in a hotel in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, which is this fancy neighborhood in Paris. And they were quite wealthy London people, they said when they came every day near the metro stop where they got on the train to come, there was a woman begging, and she didn't have any shoes. And so this woman, who was coming to the retreat, brought her a pair of shoes, bought her some shoes and gave them to her. And the next day when she came back, the woman was sitting there and she didn't have any shoes. And so this peacemaker woman was really, really angry about this and was talking with Bernie. I happened to be sitting at the table when she was having this conversation. She was really angry and she said, this is, this is trickery. This woman, she just doesn't really need the shoes. I gave her shoes. And now she's sitting there without any shoes again, and Bernie said to her, within this system of castes and beggars and whatever, that is how they make their living, is begging within a caste system like that. And whatever works to make it so they get more money so that they can live, why not? And he gave this example of how in India, people. No, actually, the woman's husband was of Indian origin. He was actually an Indian Jew, which is really unusual. There's a certain tribe in India that's Jews. And he said, yeah, well, in India, I've seen people who have babies who are perfectly normal, and then they break their limbs or maim them and then send them out begging. And he was scandalized by this. And Bernie said, yeah, but that's part of the system, is that that makes that child a better beggar. And this is horrible to say this, but within the system of that has been imposed on these people, whatever it takes, to make a living. I had people in Morocco when my boyfriend at the time and I were scandalized when we went to a rug shop, and they took us to visit where the rugs were made upstairs, and it was children making the rugs. And this one little girl who was kind of dressed in rags almost was making signals to us, like, wanting something to eat or something like that. And we were just shocked. And we went all the way up to the roof, to the top floor. And on the roof, there were older children who were spying on the roof so that if the children tried to escape off the roof, they couldn't. And we came downstairs and we just really yelled at our guide and said, how can this be? How can you take us to a place like this? And how can you make this into like something, typically Moroccan, and it's wonderful that tourists should see? And he was really, he just said, you don't understand. Those children were sent there by their families because they didn't have anything to eat. And the families need the monies. And so they send them to this, and this is considered a good thing in Marrakesh to work in a rug factory in the city. So they're not outside in the fields, or they're not begging, but they're working, So we have our positions, I'm not saying that we should condone this child labor in Morocco, but we were coming with a really strong opinion about it. We didn't buy a rug, though. Maybe we should have. Maybe then the children would have had more to eat. I don't know. Yeah, maybe we can say too that because I feel that this is really difficult when we start getting into this territory. Maybe we can see that the more that we sit and just see things as they are, the easier it is to see when it's an opinion, and to see when we're fixed and attached, and then to know what the appropriate action is or something. Because it's very easy to act from these places of attachment. In fact, we do that most of the time. But the more we just sit with what is and just then appreciate the sun, the or not sun, or the greenery or not greenery. Bird song or
Can
not bird song. Yeah.
I? That story made me remember what you said before about compassion, being feeling compassion without losing yourself, and yeah, like what you said about the heat and the cold, and just it's the same thing. It's just compassion in the moment, and that independence of actions and opinions about what to do, which is sometimes there is something to do and according to that circumstance, and sometimes it's just compassion and nothing else to do. Yeah, but what I was doing is just, it's like the burning when it's heat or cooling when it's cold. Burning like compassion, completely filled compassion. Yeah. It's something, yeah.
Yeah, and we, when we hold back or when we resist, then we see that there's a struggle, and that's when suffering happens, instead of just going with it. So I'm thinking of the heat. So I'm thinking of Miguel and Anna when they had their jukais. It was so hot. Those of you who were at that retreat, well, definitely Joa was there. Tiago, I don't know if you were there or not. Juan, were you there? Yeah. No, you weren't either, huh? Interesting. So I guess Joa and I and Anna and Miguel were the only ones there. Oh, you were there, Lisa? Okay, yeah. It was so hot, and yet when you think about it, we just were hot, you know. Yeah.
Gave us the opportunity to do it in this beautiful chapel.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I was thinking with the, you know, kind of one of the ways to know when we get caught up with opinions, I feel it's so interesting to look at the how we feel on the body level, like when we get reactive, when it becomes like a sensations like out of control, like a reactivity, like something really strong that happens in the body, and then probably we know that we're not in this, we're not coming out of a space of just unconditioned, but we're very conditioned, we're very attached to our opinions and judgments and framework and cognitive framework and all that. And so it's a find it's always a good signal. The body is a good signal.
Yeah, and the more that we pay attention to that, the more we notice it too. We become aware and we recognize it when it's that tightness or when it's that whatever it is that is manifesting.
But to work in a different framework, don't we, isn't it more difficult if we're, you know, in a certain framework and, you know, it's difficult to start operating on another framework, but I guess it's possible to start a little bit at a time.
Yep. One breath at a time, one step at a time. Absolutely. Because actually, there is only this breath and there's only this step. So we can't be anywhere else but right now.
Hi, I was just listening to you talking about, you know, fixed ideas and our attachments, and for me, it's so liberating when I let go of my ideas. I really feel that frees up space in my head. It's just, then I don't need to waste energy defending myself or my opinions or what should be like this or not. So it's very liberating, just, yeah, that's it. So.
Absolutely, you know, because when we're clinging like this, it's tight and it's hard and it's uncomfortable and it's there's anger and frustration or fear or whatever it is. But if we let go, it's just easy. and spacious.
Good evening, everyone. Just to follow up from what was just said, I remember Michel Roshi. He suggests we actually do it like this. So we just tighten your hands really strong and then letting go. Just so, help us remember how it feels when what Lara was just describing. Just to help us remember how it feels. And it's really, that's how it feels. Absolutely. When we so liberating.
Yeah.
Don't need to. And then we can't even like imagine how it was just before when we were really clinging to something. It's really, really strong.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And once we have an experience like that, then we remember, oh yeah, right, that's what it feels like. Yeah. And that then makes it more familiar when the situation like that is coming up again, and then we can remember that and see, oh yeah, I'm stuck here, or I'm caught on this, or I'm hanging on to this, or whatever.
So about inviting people here, can I just give them the link?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Explain a little the protocol. We come and we sit for half an hour, and just so she knows, she's not expecting someone to start talking right away or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the link is on our website, isn't it? Or maybe not. No, it's not. Okay. Okay.
You need to send an email
Okay.
to
But
get
it's
it.
okay, Shuang. You can give it to her. That's fine. Okay, well, maybe we'll stop here then. Thank you.
I'd just like to bring a correction. It's the King Pasinadi, not Pasadena.
Right.
Pasinadi.
Pasadena, yeah,
Like,
that's
oh, it's like something is wrong.
yeah. Pasadena is in California.
Exactly. I was like, that's strange.
That's where the Rose Bowl is, yeah.